This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
To a question with the background that we've laid about suicide, active euthanasia, and passive euthanasia, we want to go on and ask ourselves, what should we do with an irreversibly comatose patient? What do we do if a person is an automobile accident, is brought into the hospital in a coma, is put immediately on life support mechanisms, and then the doctors come to the conclusion that this person will never regain consciousness or will never regain consciousness and lead a valuable life? Is it legitimate to take the person off of the life support mechanisms, to pull the plug, as insensitively the modern media puts it? One aspect of this problem, or one approach to this problem that is often heard, amounts to a hierarchicalist understanding of life. When somebody says that there's really no reason to maintain the biological life of that body because personhood has been blotted out. This individual may still have a biological functioning organism, a body, but that body will never display the active signs of personhood, will never have an interpersonal conversation, will never be able to make decisions for himself or herself. Consequently, since personhood has been lost, there's no reason to sustain the life of the body itself. I disagree with that perspective rather strongly, because we must remember that what it is that is living, if indeed it is living, what it is that is living here is a body made in the image of God. It may be that we could apply this line of argumentation to a horse. You could say, this horse is never going to return to its normal horsely functions, never going to run in the Kentucky Derby or pull a plow again, but we could keep the horse in this laying down position, breathing and blood pumping through the body. The horse will never enjoy life, will never give any enjoyment to people, but we could keep the body functioning. You might want to argue that there's no value in keeping the horse alive, but after all, the reason there's no value in keeping the body of the horse functioning is because it's just a horse. It's just an animal. It's just part of the lower creation. Whereas in the case before us, we're dealing with somebody who's made in the image of God and has value, intrinsic value, just because of that image of God that is displayed. There might very well be reason for maintaining the biological life of a human body if for no other reason that we will display thereby human dignity as the image of God. What I'm arguing here is that even in the most minimal circumstance or case, you could say that it's a testimony to man being made in the image of God that we keep this biological body functioning, even though we wouldn't keep other biological bodies, such as that of a dog or a horse, functioning as well. In other words, just one way in which we tell the world that there's a difference between humans and other animals is by keeping the human body functioning as long as we can. So if a person were to come in a coma, we should, after we put the life support mechanisms to that body, continue the life support mechanisms even after we find out there doesn't seem to be any human hope of that person regaining consciousness or personal interaction and activity. So this idea of the blotting out of personhood forgets the endurance of God's image. And if nothing else, for historic and memorable reasons, we would keep the person's body functioning as a reminder of the dignity of that human life. And now somebody suggests maybe the way out is to have a living will. A living will is a legal technique that's been developed in our own generation that allows for a person to specify not only the conditions under which he will be buried and his inheritance divided, but to specify what will happen if he is unable to speak for himself after being put on life support mechanisms or what have you. That is, people allegedly can take care of the problem we're talking about in advance by deciding right now how they'd want to be treated. so that conceivably a person's in an automobile accident, comes into the hospital in a coma, is put on life support mechanisms, and then a living will is supplied when the doctors determine the person's not going to recover. A living will is supplied where the person requests that his family not be deprived of the financial inheritance that they would have to go ahead and let him die, pull the plug, if you will. When I first heard of this possibility, it seemed eminently reasonable to me, a way of allowing for a voluntary approach to euthanasia, a person not having his interests subordinated to the interests of somebody else, but rather willingly subordinating his own interest, and therefore not having his human dignity or well-being violated by somebody else. The difficulty, however, has really become more of an epistemological one. Because if a will is to be valid, you must remember that it must be assumed that the will expresses the reasonable desire of a person and the most recent reasonable desire of a person. You know, there are cases where people have multiple wills. Some of them may be ruled out because they were not executed in right frame of mind. They may have been executed under duress or under senility. And if there are multiple wills, then the most recent one, the most recent expression of an opinion, would be the binding will. In the case of a living will, a person is signing away, in a sense, his right to change his mind. And as a matter of fact, we'll see if we do any empirical study of people, that the way they adjudicate their problems when the problem is not near at hand or pressing in upon them is very often different than the way they decide to adjudicate their problems when the problem is actually there and they feel all the full impact of its pressure. What I'm suggesting is, though it may not be in all cases and need not be in all cases for the validity of my point, it could very well be that a person that I might say in this more or less safe and academic environment, that if we ever had to go to war and we're down in the trenches and one of us has to stand up and be the point man to find the enemy, then I want to be that person because I think so highly of you, friend. I want you to stay in the trenches and to be safe, and I'll be the one who goes. Okay, now, that's easy to say now as a way of saying, you know, I prefer your well-being over mine and all that. But now put these two people in the trenches, and very often the person will say, well, let's flip a coin now to see who has to be the point man, who has to get up out of the safety of the trench and find the enemy. Often enough, when the real circumstance comes, you don't reason and make this decision that you say you would in the cold formality of your study. Now, that is especially true when it comes to self-preservation, the drive for self-preservation, as in the illustration I've just given you. And consequently, from a prima facie standpoint, if ever there were to be a case for questioning whether a person would change his mind, it would be in the case of a living will. The living will says, I don't want my life protected, go ahead and let me die. But if the person were conscious, or let's say the person came in a comatose situation and the living will is adduced, and the doctor said, we're going to allow this person to die, and then for, say, even a miraculous reason, the person regains consciousness for a few seconds. And in those few seconds, the one thing the person says is, don't let me die, and is out again. Now what do you do? The living will says, I want you to let me die. The person in 15 seconds of consciousness says, I don't want to die. You see the difficulty? The difficulty is that you have to presume continuity between the living will executed in cold formality in a situation that doesn't really impinge upon the person, and you have to assume that the decision made there is continuous with and would be the same as the decision now made by the patient if, hypothetically, the patient could speak for himself or herself. And I believe that it is highly reasonable, eminently reasonable, to assume that there would be discontinuity or a good chance of discontinuity. And consequently, the living will in the nature of this case, it doesn't apply to all wills, but in the case of life and death circumstances, a living will would have to be ruled undependable. How do you understand the patient's desire when the expression of the patient's desire is given outside of the circumstance that the desire applies to? I mean, do you really know what your desire is regarding life until your life is threatened? I doubt that you do. Yes. Oh, I thought there was a question. Now, there are certainly abuses of living wills, and the answer to abuses is you clear up the abuses. But you should be aware of the fact that there was a man who had signed a living will and was on kidney dialysis machine, and the kidney dialysis machine was draining the fortunes of the family. And this is an older gentleman, the grandfather in the family figure. And the family didn't want the money to keep going out. And so they went to the court and asked the court to make this man the ward of the family, to turn over all legal decisions to the family with respect to this man. The man said, I'm perfectly sane. I'm perfectly well. I ride my bike down to the medical clinic every day and get my kidney dialysis treatments. I want to live. I'm doing just fine. And the judge decided that since the man had a history of mental disturbance and had at one time apparently been institutionalized for a period of time, that nevertheless he wasn't competent to handle his problems, turned over all legal decisions to his family. The family then used the living will as their out and deprived him of the use of the dialysis machine on the ground that if he was in his right mind, he would decide not to have the dialysis treatments. And the man died. That actually happened. Now, again, that seems like such a bizarre situation that you'd think there are ways of handling that kind of problem. But it does point at least to the danger of signing away your options about your own life. A living will actually puts into the hands of others the legal decision about your life. There's not only the epistemological problem, therefore, of knowing whether your desire is genuine when it's not made under the appropriate circumstances. In the same way that we question a will that's signed under duress, I think we could sign a will that's not drawn up under duress when the duress is life and death for you personally. There's also the danger that you're turning over your options to somebody else. Yes.
Yes. You make out a living will that would prevent extraordinary things just in your own life.
Well, do you think that you can make the decision about extraordinary means any better than you can about ordinary means? The whole question is the legitimacy of the expressed desire when it's not a desire given in what would be considered genuine circumstances. Okay, I tell you that, well, you know, if I'm ever in this awkward situation of being up on the Rock of Gibraltar, then you can assume that here's what I'd want done. Well, I mean, until you're actually up there and facing the cliffs and the dreadful drop and all the rest, I don't know exactly what sort of decisions to make. Because all I can do is imagine what it would be like to be on the Rock of Gibraltar. Similarly, all I can do is imagine what it would be like for me to be suffering in a hospital room, but conscious that although I'm willing to die, my family is undergoing a great deal of pain and the burden here. I can only imagine that. Since I can only imagine it, and there is so often a change of opinion when the rubber hits the road and it's a life and death situation, I'm not sure a living will can be deemed a valid instrument, a valid legal instrument. I mean, unless we just want to play out a legal fiction. We say, well, we agree with you. A lot of people do change their mind when, in fact, they are facing death. But after all, what else are we going to do in such circumstances? So we're going to perpetuate the fiction that the living will is a genuine expression of the person's desire.
Well, thank you, God.
Okay, what point does that? Well, it seems to me what that shows is the fallibility of the doctors who say that this person's irreversibly in need of the life support mechanism, that if you once took the person off, then they would die. Well, doctors aren't very good at making decisions about irreversibility. Even if they became better at it, there's still the question of fallibility for a doctor. Well, let's move on now from the question of the blotting out of personhood in a comatose person and the attempt to deal with that through a living will to the very difficult question of the criterion of brain death. The American Bar Association, by the way, along with a number of other institutions, like I think of proposals made in terms of the Uniform Brain Death Act proposed in 1978 by the National Conference of the Commissioners of Uniform State Laws, the American Bar Association I've mentioned, the AMA. A number of groups have suggested criterions for death to help us out of situations like that which I've just mentioned. In fact, 19 or so statutes that have been undertaken to define and establish in law a brain-related criteria of death or criterion of death as based on scientific procedures. And the assumption is that these scientific procedures are reliable and that we should all accept the idea of brain death. A couple of years ago, I was asked to come to a hospital and to counsel a family, a Christian Reformed family, whose doctor told them that the grandmother, who was on life support mechanisms, a respirator in particular, counseled the family to turn the respirator off because they had taken electroencephalograms and there had been no brainwave activity, and therefore they said she was really technically dead. They were just keeping her other functions going. Because the brain was dead, she herself was dead. Boy, I'll tell you, even after I had taught ethics for 3 years or so and had been writing in the area and reflecting on the subject for some time, you know, all of a sudden, you take away the paper-thin character of your reasoning when you have to help the family make the decision, do they or do they not submit to this idea. And the very idea of brain death seems so reasonable to me, and it's something that I've been studying since that time and have now come to really an opposing viewpoint, and I think it would be very dangerous to accept the idea of brain death as defining death. And I'm going to get into some detail on that. I think it's very important for Christians to know something about this today, because that is what, in fact, doctors, some malicious, but I think most in goodwill, are really proposing as the way out of a dilemma of the comatose person. But before I argue against it, let me just suggest from a Christian standpoint some motivation for looking for this type of criteria. The law of God forbids abusing a body after its death. The law of God requires that the body be buried with dignity before sundown, for instance. Now, there are, of course, the exceptions of when covenantal curse comes against the person, the body may be left in a humiliated state or may be left for the beast and the birds to feed upon. There are extraordinary circumstances, but the ordinary expectation in the law of God is that because the body has dignity made in the image of God, that even though the body may be dead, the body is to be buried and not to be abused. Sir?
Raise just a quick question. Do you think that the consideration of the body under ordinary circumstances is not Christian?
Yes, I believe that as a general rule of thumb, or at least let's put it this way, a beginning point, very important beginning point for reflection on cremation, is the fact that we owe dignity to the human body even after its death. And now somebody can come along and argue that cremation is not undignified, but it is acceleration of the destruction of the human tissue. It does, strikes me aesthetically anyway, as being undignified. And so there's a lot more that has to be argued out on that point. But I would begin with the obligation to show dignity even to a dead body. Now, if that is true, then that means we shouldn't be simply manipulating dead bodies either. It would be wrong to manipulate a dead body. And if somebody could, on good, solid grounds, argue that this grandmother, in the case that I referred to, was dead, and that what we are doing simply is just plugging a lot of artificial human machines into her, then it seems to me you might want to argue, well, that's grotesque, that's really terrible, it's abominable. We should turn off the machines and have the body buried with dignity. You don't continue to manipulate a dead body. And so there is some reason for us to be highly motivated, especially if we honor the Old Testament law, to be highly motivated to make sure we have some understanding as to whether brain death does define the death of the body. Now, my own conviction, however, is that while I don't have an alternative to present to you, and it's not my obligation to have one, in order to say that the one that has been given is poor, I mean, we still see how bad it is, even if we don't have a better one to propose. The fact of the matter is that brain death and the reasoning about brain death is highly questionable, both empirically and logically. Now, when we speak of definitions of death, we have to begin by drawing a sharp distinction between two quite different modes of defining things. On the one hand, death is a word that we use to name some empirically given state of affairs, a state which may be difficult to describe in full generality, yet which is one which we're all too familiar with. That is, we can define something as death, or we can use the word death simply to name an empirically given state. Now, someone we have known, for instance, ceases to breathe, sags wherever not supported. We can find no pulse. There's no sign of interactivity, no sign of reaction when the doctors apply pressure to the proper points. All is silent in the body, inert and cold. The body grows rigid. Later, the body becomes flaccid. Then the body begins to putrefy, decomposes, and finally only bones remain. You know, when you describe it that way, there's no question, is there? That's death. When we say that, what we mean is, empirically, you've just described what we name as death. Perhaps most important, from a certain point on, what we call the moment of death, whatever happens, whether it involves putrefaction, mummification, incineration, vaporizing of the body through nuclear explosion or what have you, whatever happens is entirely describable in terms of disintegration, dissolution, or destruction of the unity of the single organism that was formerly present. A human being has, so far as this world can tell, simply ceased to be. And we know that the soul lives on, but nevertheless, from standpoint, empirical standpoint of this world, once there's this disunity that begins in the body, the decomposing process, we say the person's dead. Now, on the other hand, at all times, people have attempted, it seems to me, when using the word death, not merely to refer to some experiential given state of affairs, the one that we've just mentioned, but to say what that state of affairs is, to explain it where possible, at least to describe it in terms of the concepts that are found useful for describing the rest of the universe. That is, we want to use some natural scientific description that will offer an explanation of what's taking place. Now, that is to offer a re-description then. In the first place, I gave you a description. I said the body becomes flaccid, becomes cold, begins to decompose. That would be a description of death. Now somebody comes along and offers a re-description of death by way of scientific explanation. Such a re-description and ultimately explanation of death can be seen as a definition of death within the framework of a worldview, within the framework of some single system of thought or some ideology. These will always be what we call context-dependent definitions. None of these context-dependent definitions are, as such, empirically given. And that is something you must recognize from the outset. An explanation is not found in the natural world. Explanations are found in the minds of men. And therefore, anybody who defines death in terms of a cessation of breathing, a cessation of brain function, all the rest, is offering us a context-dependent explanation. It's not giving us something that is empirically given. None of these proposed definitions of death express solely what are matters of medical fact, though some definitions may elevate certain descriptive elements higher than other explanations. And there may be a greater preponderance on empirically verifiable elements in one definition. Somebody says, I define death as the soul leaving the body. Another person says, I define death as the cessation of breathing. Now, clearly, cessation of breathing is easier to measure than the soul leaving the body. But nevertheless, they are both explanatory definitions, and they are context dependent. The shallow approach to so profound a reality as death taken by a number of medical and legal ethicists today who consider death not to be a fact but a matter of mere use of language or convenient social stipulation seems to arise from their confounding the two basic kinds of definitions that we're talking about here. Now, in terms of jurisprudence, the non-empirical and context-dependent explanatory definitions that are offered by men, be they theologians or philosophers or even scientists playing the part of philosophers and lawyers, have in the past been carefully avoided in courtrooms, if for no other reason than that the court doesn't usually have the competence to discriminate among the various world and life view dependent definitions of death that are given. But death itself, the fact of death that we describe empirically, not the concept of death which we are trying to explain, the endlessly repeated and sorrow-laden seeming extinction of human beings is the law's concern, as it is that of ordinary people who look to the law for the protection of their lives. No moving away from the empirical notion of death can be acceptable in a court of law. The legal question being debated at present, however, is not, after all, about the definition of death, despite the efforts of some to turn it in that direction, but is rather debate about the validity of certain proposed general criteria for death. As I develop this argument, I want you to see the key turning points. We've now turned one corner here. I began by saying, even if somebody proposes a definition of death based on the idea of brain function, you must understand that that is an explanatory definition, and the law doesn't deal with explanatory definitions. The law deals with empirical observations. So we've got to keep that in mind. But as it turns out, the people proposing statutes about brain death are not even giving us a definition of death. They're offering only general criteria for death. And there's a difference between criteria and a definition. I can give you the criteria for a 55 Chevy. I cannot give you necessarily a definition of a 55 Chevy. As a matter of fact, I could do both, but you can see that it's possible to give criteria and not to give a definition. I might also be able to give you a definition of some concept, but not be able to give you criteria for its use. It seems to me people have long known that the ultimate disintegration that we call death can be foreseen without danger of error at a time well before manifest putrefaction of the body. For example, once rigor mortis has set in and is observed by us, we are wholly certain that the person has died. With the progress of medicine, yet other clusters of empirical signs occurring still closer to the moment of death have been found to be reliable indicators that death has occurred. Such sets of signs as rigor mortis and these more recently validated ones we call general criteria of death. To verify the presence of a general criterion requires, in turn now, the use of subordinate or secondary criteria. Many observations and tests may have to be made and many factors considered if we are to have full certitude in the difficult cases. But it is essential to note, neither subordinate nor general criteria define death itself. None of them are what we mean by the word death. Person says, I see a zebra, and then a scientist explains the seeing of a zebra in terms of certain electronic functions within the brain, it would be ridiculous to say that when the person said, I see the zebra, the person was talking about electronic functions within the brain. And so it may very well be that if you have a general criteria of death, that's all well and good and accurate, but that isn't what we mean by the word death. They are merely specifications, be them general or particular, of the sorts of observational data that would enable us validly to conclude the fact of death in a particular case. Now, most of the definitions of death under current discussion, namely irreversible cessation of total brain function, turn out to be, on inspection, just such general criteria. All general criteria used as a standard up to now have developed from the intention to make sure that a person who is still alive will not be treated as though that person were dead. That's a crucial insight, I think. Most of the general criteria that have been offered up until most recently have intended to protect the presumption of life, to make sure we don't treat a person who's alive as though he were dead. The motivation behind the new brain-related concepts of death, the proposed new criteria are intended to be used in exactly the opposite sense, to prevent someone from being treated as alive when he is already dead. One is concerned now to prevent the possibility that present-day life support systems might mask death and cause a corpse to mimic life at the expense to the living, in suffering, or in money. In the past, a mistaken determination of death usually had no other result for a dying patient than his being allowed to die without further treatment. But the new criteria are intended not only to decide as soon as possible when someone is dead, but among other options to clear the way for the taking out of his vital organs, action which, if a mistake has been made, is certainly to kill the still-living patient. Okay, let's go back a century and say that we use as our criterion of death, or criteria of death, breathing. And the doctor comes into the room, the guy's laying on the floor, can't get any sign of breathing from the person, and he says, okay, I certify that this person's dead. Then you put him on a table and they wheel him over to the morgue, and the guy lays there until the time of his burial. Well, you know, the only consequence, of course, is that you haven't given him further treatment that you might give him, and that's because you were convinced that he was dead. But in our day and age, if we make a mistaken determination of death, it isn't just that the person's going to live out the next few hours or so until the funeral. The mistaken interpretation is going to lead us, in many cases, to make use of the vital organs and thereby kill the person. Now, granted, that's not in all cases, and maybe not statistically in many of them, but the fact remains that that shows you the logical difference between what we're doing now and what was being done a century ago. Since any criteria nowadays must subserve questions of organ transplantation as well as other purposes, any new general criterion of death must be at least as certain as the older one, since a mistake here couldn't turn out to be a lethal mistake. Yet, as I think we'll see, the proposed criteria of brain death are far less certain than the older criterion would be, or the older criteria would be. The recent ones are, I will argue, not merely uncertain, but certainly wrong in principle. The first thing I want to point out now as we actually take on this brain-related concept of death is that nothing describable as brain function is simply equivalent to human life. Nothing describable as brain function is simply equivalent to human life. Though, once the brain is formed, human life usually, but not always, requires some kind of perduring function of the brain. I will then argue that cessation of function, whether it's irreversible or not, has no necessary connection with either destruction of the brain or death of the person, and therefore cannot serve as a general criterion of death. Okay, so let's begin with this idea of brain function as equivalent to human life. Those who speak of the brain-related definitions of death today often speak of brain function. In fact, most of the statutes that I've read use that phrase, brain function. But is there such a thing as the brain function? Or should we not rather be speaking of the functions of the brain? Before considering the medical aspects of this question, it's important to dispose of an all-pervasive philosophical sleight of hand that I think constitutes the unconscious root of most arguments that have been advanced on the subject here. The following line of reason strikes me as being what we have to deal with. Somebody says, the brain, or some selected portion of it, is that organ whose specific function it is to make a human person be alive. The brain cannot, therefore, by definition, cease this function without making the person cease to live. Hence, cessation of total brain function, not brain functions, some very few of which, apart from this primary one, may continue for some time after death, by the way. Brain function is, by definition, identical with death of the person. Now, were this argument valid, and I think you often feel the prima facie force of it, and it's certainly a common argument, were that argument valid, however, any cessation of total brain function would be, by definition, death. The recoveries of all those who have shown for many hours, even days, therefore, no discernible trace of any brain function as a result of various depressant drugs or hypothermia would have been resurrections from the dead. And you can't avoid that conclusion. It's one of those QED situations. Brain death means death of the person, or cessation of brain function means death of the person. We have people who are identified as having no brain function, and yet they have come back to life. They're resurrected. And if it is objected that such people did not really suffer cessation of total brain function, but only seemed to suffer that cessation, then what we're being offered as a criterion is empirically unable to do the very job it was intended to accomplish. That is always the cop-out that people will use to say, well, it only appeared that my criterion was met. But don't you see that in this particular case, it's just the appearance that we're interested in. It's when things appear to be the case, should we declare the person dead? There's no brain function apparent, so is the person dead? Philosophically, the argument implies, all unnoticed by so many of its proponents, I think, a strict materialism. It reduces the life of the human person to one of the proposed organic functions of the material brain. Brain function is so defined as to take the place of some kind of immaterial principle, the principle of soul or personhood within man. Of course, such a materialism is a widely held philosophical option today, and maybe for various ethical and social reasons preferable to some individuals, but it certainly is not apologetically defensible. It stands in flat contradiction to the teaching of the Bible, and therefore cannot be accepted by Christians, even if were it to be accepted by the society at large. But whatever the merits of the argument, philosophically or theologically, I want to point out that its medical presuppositions are recognized by some writers as untenable. For you see, the brain consists not of a single part, but of several closely interrelated parts, cortex, cerebellum, midbrain, medulla, and all the rest. Though composed of superficially similar tissues and closely linked together both anatomically and physiologically, these parts can continue to live and act independently of one another, even when one or more of them has been destroyed. The brain is composed of many parts, and the parts can, as a matter of fact, function independently. As one might then expect, the brain as a whole has no physiologically identifiable single function that could rightly be called the life-giving function or the function of the brain as organ of the whole. That is, there is no one function of the brain, certainly no one life-giving function of the brain. There exists, by contrast, a large multiplicity of different functions that are characteristic of the different parts of the brain. We noticed that just recently in the news coverage of the shot that was taken by President Reagan's press secretary, Brady. There was a great deal of discussion as to what the outcome was going to be in his life, given that portion of the brain that was affected by the bullet. All the characteristic functions of the brain parts normally are closely coordinated, of course, I don't deny that. Each part can function without the others, nevertheless. Further, none of these parts is in complete control of the others, and thus the cortex usually controls voluntary motor activity, but reflexly yields control to the midbrain if, for example, one trips while they're running. Okay, there are certain things. One part of the brain will take over. It's kind of fascinating, as I've done some research on this, to be reminded of what the human brain does. But if you're running, the midbrain controls the running, you see, the decision to put one foot ahead of the other. But if you should happen to trip over something, there will be a reflex action to put your hands out, and you won't deliberate on it. Your cortex will just take over, and your hands will fly out to protect you. In consequence of this fact, each set of secondary medical criteria that have been proposed for ascertaining brain death looks or tests for the absence of the characteristic functions proper to each of the brain parts singly. If all tests for these various functions in the individual brain parts turn out to be negative, the neurologist using those criteria is considered justified in asserting that the brain is dead, at least by the standards that he's using. Multiple criteria are required because of the multiplicity of the parts of the brain and their different functions. No single criterion is ever offered as uniquely testing for this alleged function of the entire brain. The brain is, then, an organ whose varied functions serve to integrate physiologically the different parts of the body. Such physiological operations of integration are, in fact, the ordinary conditions for the continuance of the orgasmatic unity of the body. But if, quote, total brain function, end of quote, can legitimately mean no more than the sum total of the characteristic functions of all the parts of the brain, then the brain ceasing to function does not imply a priori its destruction but implies only its loss of physiological activity. Admittedly, this is a loss that usually tends quickly, if not instantaneously, to the destruction of the brain and to the disintegration of the body that we call death. All I'm saying here, though, is that you can drive a wedge between the idea of the functioning of the parts and the death of the brain as a whole. Now, I want to point out another logical fallacy, also often overlooked here. There is a non-equivalence between the destruction of the brain and the loss of its function. If irreversible loss of brain function cannot be a general criterion of death, we still have to consider the question, if there is an irreversible loss of all the characteristic functions of the brain, must we say the brain has died? That is, must we say that it's been wholly destroyed? The converse, of course, is rather obvious. The total destruction of the entire brain does imply irreversible cessation of every kind of brain function. If the brain's dead, then we would all grant that there's no more function. But do we need to grant that if there is no function, the brain is dead? Now, if the implication works both ways, then you have an identity, of course, and there's no problem. But I'm going to suggest that it doesn't work both ways. Whether total destruction of the brain is simply equivalent to the death of the person is something that would further have to be considered. Okay, and that's something that would be more theological in orientation, and I've already suggested my answer to that question. There are evidently many varieties of reversible cessation of brain functioning that are known to medical science. Most of these are non-destructive reversible cessations. But we know of no medical principle that requires that a non-destructive cessation of function must always be reversible. That is, this implication has not been empirically demonstrated, that non-destructive cessations of function must always be reversible. So that if this cessation is non-destructive of the brain, therefore it is a reversible cessation of the function. We don't know that equivalence at all. There is no evident contradiction in supposing the existence of permanent synaptic barriers that might be analogs to some kind of toxin or morphine that affect the brain. There's no logical reason why you couldn't have what we call a permanent synaptic obstruction in the brain. And yet other mechanisms that would block all brain functioning while leaving the brain's neuronal structure intact and ready for action. That is, at least until such time as the effects of the non-function of the synaptic interchange have been restored. And it's one thing to say, after all, that his heart has stopped beating, and it's another thing to say that his heart is dead. There is no reason to think that cessation of function, whether reversible or irreversible, necessarily still less death of the person, as I've already suggested and will continue to suggest. The same distinction applied to other organs and functions has been of major importance for the advance of medical science, hasn't it? For centuries, irreversible cessation of breathing was taken as a sure token of death, or its immediate presence. Once it was realized that the bronchial tree and lungs need not have been destroyed by the irreversible cessation, the advent of medical ventilators was assured. Okay, we come to the conclusion this man's lungs aren't going to work on their own anymore. Now, if we all assumed, well, that means the lungs are dead, nobody ever would have been led to create the medical ventilator. But it's just because we see the difference between cessation of function and death of the organism that we've developed a machine that will keep the organism going, even though the function will not automatically be assumed by the organism. Not very many years ago, cessation of heartbeat was taken as equivalent to death. Medically, it seemed to be irreversible, and yet physicians came to see that so long as the heart itself as a muscle was not destroyed by the arrest of its function, a potentiality for continued function remained, and because of that potentiality being recognized, various means of cardiac resuscitation were developed in our century. Moved by such considerations, many doctors have begun successful brain resuscitation in cases where both brain-related criteria and the older, generally accepted ones have justified a declaration of death. There are cases where doctors who want to be pioneers, who want to hold on to life, doctors who want to pursue the limits of our dominion and creation, have said, I realize all of the accepted criteria of death are here, but we're going to make the effort to resuscitate the brain. Why not? Logically, there's no reason against it. Once again, it is the existence of the organ that is primarily significant, not its functioning. Thus, the statutes that have sought to turn a loss of brain function into a general criterion of death are all vitiated by a fundamental category mistake. They take that which functions to be simply identical with its functioning. They take that which functions to be identical with its functioning, so that if the functioning has ceased, then the thing that was functioning has ceased as well. And that's just a gross mistake. Even if it empirically would have any bad consequences, logically, it still wouldn't be justified. If something irreversibly ceases to function, its existence is not necessarily extinguished thereby. It merely becomes permanently idle, not non-existent. Non-function, no matter what qualifiers are used, is not the same thing as destruction. Okay, I'm going to have to hurry up this presentation. Let me make the next point here. I'm just chipping away and chipping away and chipping away at this. There are two types of definition. We're being given a definition, if at all, that is not functional in a court of law. Secondly, we're not even being given a definition. We're being given general criteria. Thirdly, there are logical mistakes being made in the suggestion of this general criterion. First of all, there is no such thing as the brain function. There are many functions of the brain. Secondly, there is a non-equivalence to be recognized between the loss of function and the destruction of the brain. Thirdly, the statute talks about irreversible loss of function. Irreversible. But where in medical science can you get that modal concept? And where does the doctor look? What kind of microscope does he use to determine irreversibility? Notice the end of that word, ability. Doctors can describe what is the case. It's not functioning now. They can describe previous cases where we haven't seen this function restored. But how can they tell us what is irreversible? How can they tell us the limits of empirical possibility here, or medical technology and all the rest? Then there is the problem that the length of time between the cerebral insult and the taking of an EEG, the fact that this length of time considerably modifies the diagnostic power of a single 30-minute reading of an EEG. There are cases, although my research says that they are rare, and we have to admit that, there are cases in which tracings subsequent to a flat EEG show a return of activity in the brain, sometimes only after 24 hours or more. That is to say, here's the cerebral insult, either a blow to the brain, lack of oxygen to the brain, toxic poison, whatever it is that stopped the brain from functioning. The amount of time that is spent between that insult to the brain and the taking of the reading of the brain will often affect the value, the diagnostic dependability of the reading. There have been cases where for a period of time, a 30-minute period of time, there's been no brainwave activity at all, just flat brain scan. That's it. And 24 hours later, there's activity. And that's scary. Somebody can say, well, that just goes to show our machines are not well enough devised. But after all, that is a crucial point when you're talking about an empirical criterion of death here. If a patient whose whole brain has been destroyed is put on a respirator, even by the older criteria of death, with only the rarest of exceptions, I'm told, would that patient survive more than a week or so. What I'm saying here is that if a person's whole brain has been destroyed and you put the person on a respirator, it's very rare that that person will be able to go on for more than a week without the older signs of death setting in the body anyway. So when all is said and done, what I want to suggest is that there are logical, theological, and empirical reasons for us being extremely cautious in accepting the criterion of brain death. I already told you at the outset of the lecture, sadly, I am not a physician, and I cannot tell you what might be a more fruitful hypothesis to pursue. However, I am a logician and a theologian of sorts, and I can see that there are real problems for us as Christians with the proposed idea that the irreversible cessation of brain function means death. It doesn't even mean the death of the brain, much less the death of the person. And even if it did, I have no idea how a physician could tell us what is irreversible.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bahnsen, visit our website, bahnseninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.